it's aligning our economic system for health and for climate resilience. I think that is so critical. And that economic system goes from what we're doing now, say at the level of the city, at the national, at the regional level, it goes from public to private. Health is a public good. And so if we have a market system that is not working for the public good, then that needs to change.
Greetings, good people. I'm Kumi Naidu, and you're listening to Power, People and Planet, a series of candid conversations with activists and community leaders from around the world, aiming to tackle the biggest questions of our time. What's race and inequality got to do with climate change? Is our current economic and political system even capable of restoring nature or tackling inequality? And how do we start to rebuild trust, even a new social contract, between citizens and people in power? Today, we are joined by Tolula Oni, a public health physician and urban epidemiologist. Tolula grew up in Lagos, Nigeria, and today is a clinical senior research associate with the University of Cambridge, as well as an honorary associate professor at the University of Cape Town. Her research and her work focus on understanding the health transition, honing in particularly on the connections between cities, health, and inequality. As COVID-19 continues to rage around the world, today's episode is about human health and how it connects to nature as well as inequality. So Tolula, it's such a pleasure to have you with us today. You have an amazing story to tell, growing up in Lagos and then forging a career as an urban epidemiologist. Can you briefly tell us what motivated you to pursue this line of inquiry of human health? But before we go there, is it true that you sort of knew what you wanted to do when you were like 7 years old, when you saw a documentary and figured out that you want to be a cardiologist and an epidemiologist?
Firstly, Kimi, thanks so much for the invitation. It's really, I look forward to this conversation. And yes, you've clearly done your homework on this. And I indeed, it's not what I ended up doing, but I do remember, I'm not sure why, watching open heart surgery on a kid and some documentary, it must have been about 6, 7, 8, and thinking, that is amazing. Like, that's what the body looks like on the inside. And we can actually, you know, from the outside, do something to make people better. And obviously, being a kid at that point and being operated as a kid, I thought, that's what I want to do. so that's kind of where the seed was sown, if you like.
Well, all I can say is that when I was that age, had I seen something like that, I would have run in the other direction. So Tolula, just let's talk about you a little bit. You know, when I think about you, the three things that stand out, it's progressive public health, youth empowerment, and a commitment to the African continent. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, what makes you tick, and what perhaps is, what's driving you at the moment? What are the issues that maybe keep you up at night or get you up early in the morning?
Or both. You know, Kumi, it's a really interesting question. When people ask me, you know, what makes you tick, one of the things that I find even more striking when I reflect on it is what made me tick to start off with, what made me realize I wasn't ticking, you know, prior to that point. So that first tick, that first moment, is one of the things that comes to mind. So for me, one of that moment came when I was in medical school, actually, and I was took a year out to do to study international health, as it was called then. So I did a separate degree in that, and that completely broke my frame of thinking from the day to day of medical school. Because for a start, it really involved critical thinking, right? Which, I'm sorry to say, certainly the old-fashioned medical curriculum didn't, to a large extent. And secondly,
well, most academic curriculums don't, unfortunately.
Right, which is a bit of a paradox. But secondly, it connected what was happening in front of me in terms of health to the globe, You know, so it was the first time I really saw how, yes, we talk about ill health and keeping people healthy or getting people healthy, but suddenly just seeing all these ripple effects of, yes, but beyond the drugs that they need to stay healthy, or even actually if you just focus on the drugs, how do they access it, who is able to access and who isn't. And interestingly, my thesis, this was in 2000, so my thesis was on with Médecins Sans Frontières in the UK, and it was titled "But They Have No Watches," and that came from the head of the USAID at the time around access to HIV treatment, and the narrative was we can't provide those drugs in Africa because Africans don't have watches, and if they don't have watches, they can't tell the time, and so they can't take the drugs, and so they'll mess things up for the world. So my thesis was then looking at the Médecins Sans Frontières programs in different parts of the world and looking at the adherence, and they actually show that, surprise, surprise, you don't need an actual watch on your hand to be able to tell the time and to take the drugs. So that kind of thinking about even just treatment, the inequalities and the factors beyond healthcare. So this was around the time that the World Trade Organization was just founded, and thinking about intellectual property. And these are all things that you don't get taught in medical school. You just think, okay, you need these drugs, here you go. And then beyond the treatment, all the other factors that influence your health that we in the healthcare space had no control over. And I remember somebody saying, you know, did you know that the majority of factors that influence health lie outside of healthcare? Anyway, back to healthcare. And I thought, well, no, hang on. Can we talk about the 80% of factors? Because doesn't it make sense for those, if 80% of those factors focused on health, then wouldn't that make it easier to keep people healthy? So that year for me was my first tick, you know, when I thought, okay, health is more than just medicine. And when we think about actually getting people healthy and keeping people healthy, locally, nationally, regionally, globally, there's so many more actors that I play. And so that's my first awakening to that. And that's what still keeps me ticking, right? So over the years, I've slowly gone back to that and to essentially working largely outside of healthcare to say, I'm actually committed to the urban environment because cities are, you know, in the African space, you know, most African countries are rapidly urbanizing, and that environment has such a profound influence on people's health that it makes sense to focus energies on saying, how can those spaces be healthy? Because you have to make the healthy choice the easy choice. And so that's kind of how that first tick has reverberated, if you like, across my work to date. The question about what keeps me up or what gets me up early in the morning is it's missed opportunity. I feel it so strongly, I sometimes can't express it. Just the missed opportunity, both in terms of our young population as an African region, and in terms of the opportunities to do things differently. So we don't have cities that have been this way for 400 years, right? We're changing and we're growing, and we decide what it doesn't make sense to say, okay, we're going to go towards want to be Dubai or want to be New York, and then we'll start walking backwards and all the things that don't work for health or for the environment. You know, that missed opportunity to reimagine, or actually to imagine a different way is, you know.
And I suppose partly one remembers one of the greatest books to come out of Africa, Decolonizing the African Mind, because in a way that's part of, you know, we were, after colonialism, we're left with the infrastructure and so on, which set the norm. So it's a little bit of how do you deal with what was left there, but try and recover some that was lost and that which is needed in the contemporary. But I think one of the things that's also important is in this moment, you know, we really need to look at ancient wisdom, even from a health perspective. And I mean, if you go from to Hippocrates, you know, when he said, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food, right? So, you know, even if we, when we think about ancient wisdom and how our health has become so commercialized, for example, and some of the sort of more accessible, more cheaper, more usable sort of remedies, which our ancestors and our grandparents know. I can remember, you know, my grandmother almost, you know, I mean, which generally meant I had an overdose of turmeric in one way or the other. but you know, lots of traditional solutions and all have been gone. And in that sense, you know, I've been dealing with some health issues, you know, and you know, when it's in the cardiac area, it's always pills, medicine. I stumbled on this wisdom from Hippocrates, where he said, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. And in that sense, what you're saying is that the health system intersects with, you know, food, with sport, with air quality, and so on. And in a sense, you're being also just a brilliant feminist, because because feminism gave us this knowledge of intersectionality decades ago, and we have, you know, ignored it at our own peril. So thank you for bringing that intersectional sort of take into the conversation early on. But let me move a little bit now to COVID-19, you know, is often, again, billed as a health crisis, right? Something to be tackled by ministers of health. But really, it feels much bigger than that, right? And it feels much more of a system-wide crisis, right? So for you, from a health perspective, what has it exposed in terms of connections between the different issues in the current moment? And if you can just try to help us understand, you know, what does this mean for real lives and real communities?
So much to say on this, Kimmy.
Go for it.
You know, I used to, before the pandemic, as I mentioned, I spend a lot of time with food people, with urban planners, with architects, and with energy people, with engineers, because that's where health has been made. And I spend, and I still do, but spend a lot of time convincing people that what they do, that they were health professionals. I joked once, I was talking at an architect's conference, that I should make a badge to give these things to say, I'm a health professional, ask me how. Because I said, well, I happen to be a healthcare professional as well as a health professional. But actually, I think the architects are health professionals, the engineers are health professionals, because what they do matter more for health and maintaining health than the healthcare professionals. So that was where a lot of my conversation started before. Then the pandemic hit. And actually, you know, it became very obvious very quickly that health was everybody's business. Can you imagine a scenario where businesses said, oh, no, we're not in the healthcare space, so this pandemic has got nothing to do with us. We're just going about, not in pharmaceutical industry, so this pandemic has got nothing to do with me. Or, you know, so that didn't happen. You know, in the acute phase, you had car manufacturers being diverted to manufacture ventilators. You had, you know, the ministries of finance are the ones thinking about social welfare and making financial relief for people. It was suddenly, without thinking about it, It felt natural, right? It didn't feel like it should be, oh, the Ministry of Health and the pharmaceutical and healthcare people can deal with this whilst we go about our business. And the point is that feeling of that natural feeling actually permeates beyond the pandemic. So I took that opportunity. So, I mean, it was just and it still is such a devastating emergency that is started off as a disease, but quickly became a cross-societal issue, because obviously it highlighted the health inequalities, and as a result, the determinants of health inequality. So the inequalities with respect to jobs, with respect to housing, with respect to the environment, with respect to your ability to socially distance, to the your ability to be physically active in a safe way, your ability to isolate from your household if you are sick, your ability to not go to work, not go out, you know. All of these things were not distributed equally. And at the start of the pandemic, the rhetoric was, you know, we're all in this together. This is a global thing. But it quickly became apparent, unsurprisingly, for people working in inequalities, that we are not all in. We might be in the same storm, but we're not in the same boat. Some people are in, you know, luxury cruise liners, and some people are in dugout canoes. And so it's not. I was talking to a friend of mine very early on in the pandemic, she's an infectious diseases specialist, and so obviously very busy at this time. And she was working in a part of London, in her hospital, where there is huge diversity, so huge ethnic diversity, primarily South Asian diversity. Prior to the pandemic, there was conversations of shutting down the emergency department of that hospital. You know, it wasn't surprising to her, obviously, that, you know, and we see cases of like tuberculosis in London. You know, London is medium level. It's not a low level, some parts of London, in terms of TB, you know, but everyone else's day to day, like, oh, TB, that was a thing of the past. Like, well, not in some parts of London, you know, and this is something that is treatable, where you have free access to help, to the treatment, etc. So all of that inequality was very quickly exposed. Also exposed was the approach, right, to addressing the pandemic that perpetuated that inequality. So it's one thing to have inequality to start off with. It's another thing to not recognize and tailor your response to that inequality.
You know, and I think what we saw was a very, you know, what I thought was an interesting, for the first time, appreciation of health workers. And, you know, not only top-end health workers, but, you know, all health workers, including people who work in the health system and play critically important administrative roles without which the whole system collapsed. And then the other thing I was struck by was essential workers, this term essential workers. Suddenly, we were told by the very governments that demean, disrespect, ensure that these people are underpaid. Suddenly they say, oh, these are the essential workers. Everybody else stay at home.
Yeah, right.
And these are the people who are not on unionized jobs. They are people who work in our local stores, who are bringing food, cleaning our streets, and so on. And I hope, you know, if there's one thing that comes out of this moment, is a kind of re-evaluation of what is essential. Right? Because you see, I you might have heard me say this, but I wrote an article some time ago called, a year ago when the pandemic sort of started, called COVID is horrific, but affluenza is the worst disease that humanity is facing, right? And by that I'm meaning this pathological belief that a good, decent, meaningful life comes from more and more and more material acquisitions and so on. So I want to use that as a bit of a transition here to say, well, okay, all of this is happening, right, Tallulah, and how does this change the relationship? Or how in the last year has the relationship between people and the governments or citizens and the state changed? Do you have a sense that people are feeling more or less trusting of people in power? And why is the trust important, you know, when it comes to public health or public policy generally?
I'll respond to that. I just want to mention one thing. When you talked about that realization that we have these essential workers and what that means going forwards, I want to tie that in to what it means to do better afterwards, right? So when we talk about building back better, What does that mean? You know, because there's a dissonance, and this relates to trust. There is a dissonance between what we profess to be of value and what we actually value and what we incentivize as value. And that disconnect breeds distrust. One of the interesting things going into the pandemic was that it very quickly into the pandemic, it became clear that the rankings of countries by, you know, we have these global health security index rankings, which were supposed to tell us which countries would be prepared, were most prepared for an epidemic, a pandemic of that sort, or most robust, most resilient. And to say that there wasn't, to say that that ranking was inaccurate is an understatement.
Put it in mildly.
In fact, there was an almost perfect, at least certainly in the initial phase of the pandemic, an almost perfect correlation.
An inverse reality.
Just a reverse reality. And part of the reason, and people have been doing work looking at, well, what does it mean? What was excluded? What should have been included in that index? And there are key things around trust in the government and participation of the citizenship in decision making that was not included and that was taken for granted. And if you look at the countries that and a sense of social cohesion, which is, you know, these things are all tied together. And if you look at the countries that fared well, certainly in the initial phases of reacting, there were countries where you had a greater trust in the government, where you had greater social cohesion, and where you had greater engagement and participation of communities in decision-making processes and in responses and tailoring of responses to mitigate the impacts of the pandemic. So I think that is very striking and says it all.
It is.
I have this related to trust. I struggle with this issue most recently in the context of vaccination uptake in the UK, which is what I've been focused on, because I've been engaging a lot with that notion, because we see in terms of vaccination uptake differences in Black and brown healthcare workers and right through to across all the different age groups with lower uptake in those ethnic minority groups. And so we've been having conversations as to, you know, why that is, what can be done about it, as well as having community engagement with religious organizations and community organizations and local councils, just to have a conversation, just to say, what are the issues? And one of the key things, and this has come from my earlier point about that participation, because one of the things that came through very early on is that people were very quick to say, oh, ethnic minorities, oh, there's hesitancy. You know, it's an education thing. It's a culture thing, you know, and as a dismissive thing. Whereas my experience, anecdotal as it may be, was that actually people had questions that needed answering.
Legitimate questions.
Very legitimate questions that are based on their individual experiences, their collective experiences, historically and in contemporary times, that needed answering, right? And they needed answering and by people who they trust and whoever that is, right? And the danger with alienating and stigmatizing people by saying, oh, well, you know, if only they were better educated, or is there, you know, if they go to traditional, you know, that sort of stigmatizing, is that you further alienate. Whereas actually what we're seeing is that, yes, it's slower, but you're actually seeing that creeping up. Because when you make a concerted effort to recognize that people have legitimate concerns
Absolutely.
That need to be addressed, and also, but beyond this, my main, so I was doing, I did this Insta Live event with an influencer. And so he had lots of his followers ask questions, pose questions, and we had this conversation. And one of the questions that I thought was just so excellent that gets to this point, the heart of this point, was somebody asked, well, we know that the factors that increase your risk of dying from COVID are, you know, obesity and having lung disease and not exercising and that sort of thing. So why is the government not putting as much focus on getting people access to healthy foods and physical activity as they are about getting us to take this vaccine? And I said,
Exactly. and by the way, yeah, in South Africa, during the hard lockdown, which went on for close to 2.5 months, exercise was banned even. You know, you couldn't even go outside and do exercise.
So it's the point, right? So it's, you know, it's not saying, you know, the vaccination is so critical. At the same time, we can't, we can't care sometimes, right? Because that only breeds distrust. Because if your pattern of action is showing that you don't care for your populations, and then suddenly you're saying, oh, we needed to do this. And like, well, why? Why do you now care? So we have to think, well, you know, how do we continue this and actually keep the line of communication and engagement and rethink how we, as a more bottom-up approach, how a governance for health.
Well, the way you explain that complexity around trust reminds me when I was the head of Greenpeace. I was living in Amsterdam and I learned some very nice Dutch expressions. And one of them on trust I like, which says, trust comes on feet but leaves on a horse, right? Which I think is very powerful, because I think we sometimes underestimate how hard and how long it takes to build trust. Mm-hmm. And when governments are inconsistent in their messaging, for example, as we've seen the UK government and many other governments, especially the US government under Trump on the pandemic, you know, it creates a tremendous amount of confusion and so on. So when we think about, you know, it at a much macro level, let's say, right? What do you think governments and people need to do from what we've learned, right? Because basically the way I say it, you know, especially I speak to younger people, I say, you know, there's been so much of loss of human life as a result of COVID alone, let alone the ongoing lives that we lose from malaria, tuberculosis, HIV, AIDS, which are all preventable diseases to a large extent today, but we still lose millions of people. And I always say if those lives were being lost in Europe or North America, we would long since fix the question of tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV, AIDS. But in a context where all of COVID is just, you know, now the numbers globally are in the several millions we're heading to, it would be a terrible, terrible betrayal of those lives that were lost if coming out of this pandemic, we don't learn lessons to actually move to a society that is more inclusive, more just, more fair, and more robust, so that for sure we are going to have another pandemic and we need to be, you know, able to plan and so on. But the problem is, we got a climate crisis that's on top of us right now. And the science says we have 10 years, actually 9 years, to turn things around. And time is fast running out. So within that context, there is a critical need, I think, for us to recognize that the social contract between governments and people is largely broken in many, many societies around the world. And I would say in a majority of societies around the world today. Governments are able to maintain power through spreading lies and disinformation, as President Trump did and continues to do. And not that he's, but to be fair to him, he's not the only one. Less obnoxious politicians also do the same. And in that context, we need to imagine, I think, what could a new social contract between our leaders and people be. So if I was going to say, propose to you two challenging questions, right? If tomorrow you went to bed and had a dream and Guterres, the UN Secretary General, came into your dream and said, Tallulah, you must write the specific clause on health, right, in a new social context. Meaning, what should be the commitments of governments, right, to their citizens in terms of health? And then my second question, if you were also asked to write a clause that thinks about cities as key organizing entities for humanity right now, what would be the kind of clause that you would want to put there to give people the best chance in terms of health and for those that are city dwellers?
I would put them together, put those two questions together. And I would amend, for a start, the terms of the social contract to add the planet, right? So it's a contract between governments, people, and our natural environment, our natural ecosystems. And I say that because it needs to be grounded in an ideal, right? So recognizing the heterogeneity of countries and regions and people, even within countries. So the issue is not getting everybody to do the same thing or the same approach, far from it. But the critical thing is, what is our North Star, right? What are we saying against, you know, the bottom line is that we're working together, and we're working together in a way that is sustainable. So that's how I would bring together those two questions, because the cities come in quite significantly, because cities are spaces where the natural ecosystem is being disrupted quite at accelerated pace. It's where consumption is accelerated, so it comes into that context. So by focusing on that ideal, you would focus it on the hotspots of where those activities are happening, which are cities. And then I would pick on a word that you said, that you just said in passing, which is imagine. I have been really struck by how, even in conversations with different people, even in people who are trying to do things better, right? Who are, you know, in philanthropy, and who are trying to make the world better. I'm struck by the lack of imagination.
I agree with you on philanthropy. I'm waiting to hear your other examples. But on philanthropy, more than 10 years ago, I wrote a piece called Philanthropy or Foolanthropy. Right. Well, basically, I was saying that philanthropy was deluding themselves about the impact they were having, and it was self-serving and so on. And I'm encouraged, though, just to say, if you were to look at an example, right, of how the COVID moment has had an impact, right?
Yeah.
So, like, for example, in the United States, there's been a really great, small, provocative sort of think tank called PRI. Philanthropic Initiative for Racial Equity, which was trying to push foundations in the U.S. to address the issues of structural racism in society, but also within their own institutions. And I was privileged to have been asked to serve on the advisory board when this thing started out more than 10 years ago. Today, there are about, and that was the only entity that was pushing this agenda, that today there are 300 sort of foundations and about 1,000 people that are working on the issue of structural racism. So when I look at the moment, there's possibility.
Absolutely.
But the question is whether we will have enough courage to seize the full opportunity, or will we do what we have done as humanity after every crisis, right, including the 2008-2009 financial crisis, which is we actually let the system stay largely the same.
Yep.
We rearrange the deck chairs and the Titanic a little bit,
exactly.
And humanity continues to sink in the process.
Exactly. And that's the opportunity we say something like philanthropy, right? But you have to, it has to be embedded in essentially trying to put yourself out of business and trying to do things differently. The second you're embedded in, this is how we do things, and hey, it's better than if we weren't here, then your vested interest is in the status quo and in doing your bit within that status quo, if you see what I mean. So the point I was going to make, the additional point I was going to make, is that where I have seen the most around the pandemic, where I've seen the most social imagination awakenings, has been at the community level, where you see, you know, as a response to the pandemic or the control measures. So things like in Lagos, the Market Women's Association, of the one of the largest indoor wet markets, if you like fresh foods markets, that it was normally in one space, you know, because of the lockdown, they got together and they decentralized, and they used WhatsApp to, you know, to identify so that people could put in orders, brought it closer to neighborhoods. This is a really old market. So you see these kinds of adaptations, right? You see neighborhoods, even in Cape Town, another example of community action networks, where neighborhoods got together to identify and to reimagine and say, okay, we need to do things differently now. The key question then is, how can you create the supportive environment that allows that reimagination to continue? Because when things go back to normal, it becomes harder to do things differently.
Yeah, no, in fact, this issue about normal, I during the early days of the pandemic, I actually wrote a poem, which I think I'll read at the end of the podcast, which is called, "We're All Desperate to Get Back to Normal, But Should We?" Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that there's a wisdom, you know, from Martin Luther King that I have found very persuasive when he was speaking in the mid-60s, said, "My friends, as I come to the end of my speech, I want to note that in the field of modern child psychology, there's a very dominant term called maladjusted. Now, we all want to live a well-adjusted life and not suffer from schizophrenia or other mental illnesses. But my friends, I say to you, there are certain things in our world that are so just and immoral that good, decent people should refuse to be well-adjusted." Then he goes on to say, "I never intend to adjust myself to religious bigotry, racial discrimination, and on the economy, importantly," he said, "I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few, when millions of God's children are smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in an affluent society," unquote. So I think that this moment we're in is terrifying at multiple levels, right? Especially when you add the climate crisis, the rise of, you know, fascism, nationalism, all of that. It does put a burden on us to think about how do we reconstruct a new society post the pandemic. So, for example, I don't know how you feel about this phrase, build back better, right? Because everybody says build back better, and who can disagree with that? But build back better could be like build back just slightly better, keep the system in place exactly as it is. And, you know, I keep trying to remind ourselves that, you know, what happened during the global financial crisis and the response of power immediately afterwards was all about system protection, system recovery, system maintenance. What we needed then and what we need now is what you say, imagination, right? We need system innovation, system redesign, and system transformation. And I do feel that if we don't do that in the way that you answered your first question, in a very interconnected, intersectional way, understanding our health intersects with education, our education intersects with employment and so on, and fundamentally recognizing that all of this needs to happen on a planet that the scientists tell us we've got 9 years to make major systemic changes with our energy system, our food system, and so on, if we are to avert catastrophic climate change. How does that resonate with you?
My biggest challenge with that word, with that phrase rather, build back better, to add to what you're saying, is also for whom, right? So there's the what, there's the who, there's the how and the why. You know, there's all these things, and that's why when the question around the nature of the social contract, I mentioned the planet and the environment, right? Because we have to be saying, can we all agree now that the economy and health are not two different things? You know, you are the economy, I'm the economy. If you take out people, once people stop existing, if half of the world was sick, there is no economy, right? So these are not...
As we've seen.
So they're not two different things. So if we say, let's focus our efforts on health and climate, and recognizing that health and climate are also interlinked. So there was recent...
Fundamentally interlinked.
Yeah. There was a recent paper that's just been published that looked at modeling different types of interventions to reduce the CO2 emissions and the global warming processes and climate change. And the modeling showed that if you integrated health as a central part of climate change mitigation, we achieved more quicker.
Absolutely. Even in terms of thinking about water security, food security, what kind of food, and so on. And thankfully, though, you know, thankfully, on any of the problems that we face, there is some community or several communities somewhere on the planet that's actually making things work against the odds. So to those who say that, you know, there's no alternatives and so on, we need to push back, and we need to also pick up new thinking, because, you know, I tend to quote Einstein a bit too often these days, but, you know, when he said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting to get different results.
Yeah.
We have to break out of that. And in that context, I thought I'd love to get your thoughts on, you know, how should activists, young people push their governments for more effective, robust public institutions to work for peace and stability, for inclusive, thriving economies, and so on. What are your sort of sense from where you're sitting? What would your advice be if you were put in front, especially young people? What would you advise them today?
So I think it's important to recognize that there are two approaches that need to be happening simultaneously. The first, we often default to at the expense of the other, which is being robust enough to ride out these kind of emergencies, because there will be more health emergencies, societal disruptions to come. That's the bed that we've laid for decades. So that's coming. And that's often what people talk about when we talk about resilience. What is often neglected is recognizing that the bed that we lay today, sets out that future for tomorrow, right? So the choices and the decisions that are being made today determine the preventable emergencies of tomorrow. So I love the term preventable surprises, because it captures the fact that not all surprises are inevitable, right? So we can't entirely be focused on reacting to them, right? Because some people have to be fighting that fire, and some people have to be saying, well, how do we actually not have fires? Because that is not there's nothing inevitable about that. So I think that's the one really strong message. Part of the reason that gets lost is because that is a long game, right? Because particularly both with health, so if you look at the food, the connection between our food environment and our health, if you look at the connection between our air environment and our health, that is disconnected, at least in time. So air pollution, you breathe in dirty air for a while before you get sick, right? So it doesn't have a 5-day incubation period, right? And similarly, you develop a whole part of the city with junk food and inaccessible healthy food, and then 10 years later you see that the population health is declining. So very difficult to show, like, I often use the example of the COVID. If the SARS-CoV-2 virus, so if exposure to the SARS-CoV-2 virus in London today meant illness with COVID in Lagos in 3 years' time? At the same level of catastrophe, would we act as urgently? And that is an analogy for climate change, as a good analogy for non-communicable diseases that are increasing and are really driving premature mortality. Because the problem is, we don't see, you know, it's not like an infectious disease where people are exposed and a week later you see people getting ill and another week later you see hospitalizations going up and you think, we have to do something, we have to act now. But we have to act with the same level of urgency for these preventable surprises that are just disconnected in time and often space from between exposure and outcome.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, and I think, you know, what the pandemic showed us is that making those investments, which, you know, even many political parties have been pushing for, I mean, even in the UK, if you take, you know, there was a lot of ridicule about the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn pushing for some serious investments in the health system and so on, because it was far too expensive. Where would we find that money?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's astronomical. And then suddenly the pandemic happens and we can see that you can find
tens of billions,
trillions when you add it all up together, right? And it just tells you that what is at play here is the absence of political will.
Yep.
And the good news is political will is a renewable resource, right? It can be generated, at least in several countries, we can, you know, renew those that sit in power and so on. But I'm anxious before we end our conversation that I'm not going to let you off the hook. I still want to get, if you were to think about a clause, you know, if you were put on the spot, like I'm putting you on the spot now. What would be, how would you articulate a clause in a social contract, you know, which demarcates the responsibilities of government vis-a-vis the citizens with regard to health? What would be the main thing that you would put there?
So I actually, last mid-2020, wrote a piece called The Need for a Marshall Plan for Planetary Health. And a key part of this was setting out some of the conversations that we've just talked about in terms of what the issues are and what would need to be done. And I think the first thing is recognizing that those shocks and stressors are preventable, right? Aligning, and then it's aligning our economic system for health and for climate resilience. And that,
perfect.
I think that is so critical. And that economic system goes from what we're doing now, say at the level of the city, at the national, at the regional. It goes from public to private. It goes from community action all the way to elected officials to say, well, how do we align? It's not a nice to have, you know. Health is not a charitable. It's a public good. You know, the climate resilience is a public good. And so if we have a market system that is not working for the public good, then that needs to change. We can't leave it up to the market to sort out access to good food environment, to good clean air. They have to be incentives both ways. So carrots and sticks that align economic action for that goal. And I think that is, and I keep coming back to that vision because it's often unclear to me what, you know, there's some of the cities that I've engaged in. It's like, yes, but what are you about? Like, what are you, to what end is any of your work, right? And if it's not to the end of health and climate resilience, is there any point? Right, because this is the existential threat that we face that is a vicious cycle that we can actually make virtuous. So that is, I think, my key thing would be rethinking the economic system, and that also goes down to the work that people do. Rethinking the notion of work, right? And so because I think a lot of the activities in sustainability or in preserving health, we almost defer to charitable you know, or volunteer types. We don't value that. It's not part of the economy. It's just people who do gooders, volunteer or give money to help with. It's like, no, actually, this should be a central part of our economy. In the context of unemployment rising, we should be rethinking a workforce and rethinking employment opportunities that are centered around creating health and creating climate resilience. Because there's a huge amount of opportunity there that we're not taking on. If you look at some of the responses and the interventions around the pandemic, the community actions that have been taken, and how much of that is just unpaid work that needs to be done, right?
Absolutely.
Because we value it, but not enough to make that part of the economic and workforce system. So that whole thing needs a rethink. So that's the first thing I would say. And then the second thing would be, because that's kind of more top down, I do think, and particularly this is more with the African continent in mind, because that's where the most young people are. I think we should be leading the world in terms of the social movement on this, because we have the greatest proportion of young people. And we know from, you know, if you look at the global, you know, Fridays for Future and climate, you know, you can see what young people can do. It's not just a nice to have, let's just bring them on the table and say that we have this intergenerational conversation, but actually to disrupt and to drive an unremitting demand for a post-pandemic recovery that is healthy, that is climate resilience, that is supported. And I think we underestimate and we just haven't tapped into that so much. And they exist, but they're disconnected. Because the conversations I have in those spaces, you don't have to tickle the imagination so much there, because that's easy. You can see the imagination is still very much alive there. But that connecting people together and to show that, you know, beyond imagination, this is actually happening in this small space. Let's obsess less about scaling interventions. Let's obsess more about connecting small scale interventions, you know, because actually some interventions that you do a community, maybe all you're going to do is in your neighborhood. It shouldn't need to be scaled to every neighborhood in your city or every city for it to be impactful. But if you're doing that and you're connected to another neighborhood in another city, in another country, that is, so rethinking scale. Scale is not just the individual scaling up. Scale is a network that is sensing each other and that is using and feeding off each other in a nourishing way to come up with more ideas, both in terms of how to do things differently, but also how to apply pressure and how to get into the positions of governance and of leadership where you can do things differently.
Thank you, Tsulula. That was just amazing response to that question. I'm not going to say anything other than to say that was just perfect. And I wish you well in all the important interventions that you are engaged in. And I think that the fact that a public health leader with innovative ideas says to us that my one focus, one area of focus in any social contract is ensuring that the economic system is fundamentally rethought to provide us with excellent public health, with climate resilience, and all the other needs that humanity has, is a very powerful message, which I thank you very much for. So, friends, this draws us, unfortunately, to the end of today's episode. So, Tsulula, thank you once again for sharing your valuable time and these wonderful ideas, which I hope policymakers around the world will take seriously. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Kumi, and the Green Economy Coalition. I think these are just such important conversations to be having. And so it's a pleasure to spend this time sharing some thoughts with you. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Power, People and Planet. The show is produced in association with the Green Economy Coalition, one of the world's biggest global alliances fighting for green and fair economies. We would love your help to spread the message of this podcast and the conversations within. So please do follow us and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.